The Freedom of the Shifting Sea, Jamie Go. Super Predator. E. aphroditus is a polychaete marine worm that grows up to 3 meters or 10 feet long and swims using bristle-like appendages called parapodia along the length of its body. It has a reversible pharynx and long mandibles with which it catches prey. An introduction to the deeper sea. Salma met Mayong on a sunny day in an isolated lagoon, astonishing as tourists had devoured the beaches near her coastal town. Even more astonishing, Mayong's lower body. Salma was repulsed by the waving legs at her sides, but drawn to the iridescence of the segments of her body like a centipede's, glinting rainbows in the midday sun. Mayong had shrunk back underground. Underwater underground, Salma marveled, but her face was still uncovered, her hair drifting like seaweed. Salma should have run away. Instead, she pulled on her goggles and got on her knees to investigate the sharp little face, broad nose, lush lips, beguiling eyes. Salma's hand hovered over Mayong's face, wondering if she'd dare touch it, but decided she didn't. Besides which, Mayong looked like she wanted to be left alone. So Salma left and immediately went to the library to find out what the creature could be. Not a mermaid. Mermaids were not half woman, half centipede like that. Not even a centipede, but some sort of worm. Not a spirit, she was too real. She went through a list of all the female monsters she knew and then some, but still came up with nothing. She returned the very next day to enjoy the quietness and to find the stranger sitting on a rock, eating a fish. The stranger receded into the seabed a little when Salma approached, but Salma held out her hands as non-threateningly as possible with a gift. Homemade quay.
"Assalamu alaikum," she said, wondering if the creature was Muslim. "My name is Salma."
"Walaikum salam," came the cautious reply. A pause.
"Mayong."
With this firm introduction, Salma made friends with the first non-human creature she had ever known. By the end of the dry season, Salma had learned a great deal about Mayong, like Mayong's age. Mayong could remember a time before British imperialism. Mayong's favorite dish, stingray. Mayong's length, 20 meters. And Mayong's favorite hunting grounds, a beach off the coast of Thailand, popularly considered haunted. They sometimes swam out into the ocean, Salma with a precious snorkel and mask she'd saved up for, holding gently onto Mayong's shoulders as they investigated reefs far from shore. Salma watched Mayong hunt, swift movements too fast to see, mandibles slicing creatures in half. Salma found herself unable to turn away from the sight. In turn, Salma told Mayong about changes in the human world, and the latter listened with a patient disinterest, expression flickering at odd moments that Salma thought completely boring. She confided in Mayong. Troubles at home, college applications, job seeking, boyfriends. Mayong was not always good at listening. She hated humans generally, men specifically.
"I don't really see any problem,"
Mayong replied for what sounded like the 100th time to Salma's complaint about a recalcitrant boyfriend who refused to call.
"If he doesn't want to be with you, then you're free."
"But that's not what I want. Have you ever liked anybody?"
The ensuing silence was punctuated by the sound of thunder in the distance. Mayong bobbed in the water, staring into the distance as the tide came in. Salma began picking up her sarong to go when Mayong said,
"I like you."
Salma almost slipped. She was about to respond when lightning crackled across the sky. Mayong reached out to shield her. Salma hugged her in return, feeling the cold skin, the almost human skin, slick smooth.
"I've loved many," Mayong said into Salma's ear. "Many, many. I've lost them all, to men, to marriage, to murder. And I will lose you too someday. You're too full of this world, of life on land, for the sea." Salma opened her eyes to find that Mayang had been bearing her closer to the shore, making sure she was in shallower waters.
"Don't say that. I will always come back."
Shyly, she kissed Mayang on the mouth before running off, face hot in the cold wind. The monsoon season beat down, flooding schoolyards and fields, blowing off roofs as it had done for generations. Salma went out on the better days to look for Mayang, but with little luck. Mayang's last words echoed in her ears like a portent, an omen. The lagoon lost a sandbar near its mouth, opening into a dense mangrove swamp. In low tide, the tree roots were visible with curious curves, too petted, too cultivated. Salma waded past mudskippers and fish, until she found Mayang's body, half buried in the sand, shining in the dappling sunshine. Panicked, she ran along the trail of legs, screaming Mayang's name. Mayang rolled over with a grumpy groan and blinked sleepily at Salma. She smiled.
"Hello. How was work?"
Salma clung to Mayang tightly, shaky with relief. She kissed Mayang's forehead, cheeks, and mouth. Mayang drew back, hissing, and Salma saw the inside of Mayang's mouth, the mandibles in her cheeks uncurling a little, the tiny teeth that looked disturbingly normal, and a looseness of skin behind them.
"I'm sorry, was I too rough?"
"I just woke up."
Mayang stroked Salma's hair gently.
"But I missed you too."
Just like that, their friendship continued as before, but Salma could not stop thinking of the inside of Mayang's mouth, her soft, cool skin, her vestigial breasts. Mayang's eyes glittered with amusement when she caught Salma staring, permitted the human woman's hands to linger on her waist, shoulders, even the frond-like legs on the sides of her worm body. Their arms entwined as they swam together, Mayang swimming on her back to kiss Salma's belly, knees, toes. Salma would whine as they returned to Mayang's grotto about unfairness, because Salma couldn't return the favor.
"I'm not like you," she groused,
coming to rest under a mangrove tree.
"You are not," Mayang agreed, pointedly staring at Salma's fine-haired legs. "Not with those useless things anyway."
"I can do things with these that you can't with yours."
Mayang tilted her head, raising an eyebrow. Carefully, Salma hooked her legs around Mayang's waist, drawing the worm woman closer to her. Then she wrapped her arms around Mayang's arms, determined to make sure the latter couldn't slip away. She blushed, but grinned through it anyway. Mayang brushed a tendril of hair from Salma's face, kissed her temple.
"Have you ever kissed a woman?"
Salma asked.
"Many,"
Mayang replied.
"Who?"
Salma thought maybe she sounded too demanding.
"Have you ever kissed a woman?"
Mayang asked, not deigning to answer that question. Salma nodded. Her school had been an all-girls school, although she now dated men.
"But not someone like you."
Mayang tasted like salt water, like the sea. Salma ran her fingers through Mayang's hair and down her back. Mayang smelled like warm winds over the ocean. When Salma pulled Mayang closer, she let her legs slide down and resisted a giggle when the arches of her feet brushed against the bristles along Mayang's sides. Mayang tasted Salma with what felt like multiple tongues down the length of Salma's neck, clavicle, chest. In horrified fascination, Salma watched as Mayang's jaw unhinged, pharynx extending a little to encompass the whole of one breast, and teeth at the back of Mayang's gullet tickling her nipple. Hard nubs lined Mayang's mouth, massaging, grazing. Oral membrane still extended, Mayang worked her way downwards, tickling Salma's belly, pausing right before the cleft between her legs. Mayang's eyes shone with an inner light, ghostly and still. Her arms curled around Salma's thighs. Salma tried to breathe evenly, the thudding between her legs growing and growing, her alarm at the seams on Mayang's cheeks coming apart also growing and growing. But Mayang's mouth, the inside of it, Salma reminded herself, pressed among the soft hairs there. Internally shrieking, Salma nodded. The pharynx pressed in, rubbing itself all over trembling muscle within and labia without. Salma gripped the tree roots above her head, staring up into the sky beyond the leaves, but not focusing, feeling the tide coming in around her body, feeling a tide coming inside. Mayang curled her body underneath Salma, keeping their torsos above water, for Salma to catch her breath after. She held the human woman through the ragged breathing and occasional gasps. Salma sat right on top of some of Mayang's legs that had to keep moving to steady them, and stroked Salma's hair, singing an ancient song.
You don't... How do I...
Salma frowned. Mayang laughed.
No, you can't.
Not now, anyway.
This seems unfair.
I have the freedom of these shifting seas in exchange for this small pleasure.
I don't think...
But Salma's thought was cut off as it began to rain.
You should go home, Mayang told her.
The season passed. Thunderstorms and lightning displays crashing across the skies made it too dangerous to go to the beach to look for her lover. Salma moved into the nearby town to work at her family's behest. She thought about Mayang often, but like a dream, an unreal experience with an untrue creature, as her work as a clerk took up her days. University abroad seemed even more possible than before. Then there was the fact that Salma could not speak of Mayang to anyone. What could she say?
I am seeing a woman.
To a family who would frown on the idea and assume she hadn't met a nice man to marry yet.
I am seeing a sea creature who is half a centipede.
To whom? And if one could not speak of love, was it real? Salma thought about her aunts and friends involved with married men and was vaguely envious. At least those men had identity cards to prove their existence.
I will lose you too someday.
The pronouncement almost made Salma angry to think about. By the time the monsoon season was over, Salma had convinced herself not to go looking for Mayang again. She sent out her university and scholarship applications, received acceptances, and weighed her options carefully. Let Mayang be right if she wants to be. But she felt guilty. Perhaps she should at least say goodbye. This was harder than it looked, since as soon as she had made her decision, her family suddenly clamored for her attention. Endless going-away dinners, visiting relatives, crying grandparents. When she finally found some time to look for Mayang, she worried that perhaps she had been gone too long. His name was Amir, she would find out later in the newspapers. She barely noticed him as she waded through the mangrove mid-tide looking for Mayang, dismissed the swishing of waters behind her as the waves coming in. She was about to give up, turn around, and head home when he grabbed her hair at the nape of her neck and slapped a sandy, sweaty hand around her mouth.
Oh, God, not here, not now,
Salma thrashed. She was too young to die, had too much to do. She was here to say goodbye to Mayang, not the world. She wrenched away from him, screaming, and ran. He was too close behind, and Salma turned to see his hand too close to her face. Then he yelped and disappeared under the water. There was a cloud of sand where he had been. Salma screamed and cried and screamed and cried all the way home. Aphrodite. E. Aphroditus buries its long body in the ocean bed, where it waits to ambush its prey. It moves with such speed that sometimes it slices its prey in half and drags its catch into the seabed to prevent it from escaping. Predators of the Sea, the Worm Edition. Simon saw her from a distance first, sitting pretty on boulders far from the beach, where he had taken his daughter for a long walk. Eunice had pointed her out first, and he had to squint to really see the figure, looking to the shore forlornly, like Hans Christian Andersen's mermaid in Copenhagen. They had seen the Malay mermaid on occasion since, on their beach excursions. His wife refused to join them on their walks. Salma had seen some crazy stuff that he wasn't sure he believed. Mermaids? Cannibal mermaids? He loved her, but she was insane sometimes. He thought he was going to marry a nice, moderate Muslim girl. If she'd turned out to be a fundy terrorist, that would at least be understandable. But no, he got weird confessions about some lesbian relationship with a mermaid. She probably made that shit up to make him jealous, get back at him. He couldn't help being a huge flirt. She'd liked that way back when. And what was wrong with him flirting with other women? It was just flirting, and it wasn't like he was divorcing her. In fact, Simon took really good care of her, all things considered. Roof over her head, grocery money, and all the love a woman could ask for, even if sometimes she was fucking ungrateful, unreasonable. He had to keep her in line at times. Luckily, her father understood him. Some things are shared, even cross-culturally. He supposed that with some other family, they would have interfered in the marriage by now, so he counted himself lucky and put up with their matzala jokes. He kicked a seashell into the distance, still mad at the latest fight they'd had. Wasn't she getting a trip home every year? It was expensive flying over the Pacific every winter. She hated the idea, claimed that monsoon season was too dangerous for Eunice to be near the sea. That was the latest sticking point. He admitted that he'd been a little careless. He'd been so caught up talking to that really interesting musician on the beach, he hadn't noticed little Eunice getting lost. Salma had screamed at him for hours while they lodged a police report and then stormed out in a crying rage. He'd been too tired to keep her from going out. Let her complain to her neighbors or friends or whatever. He'd tell his side of the story eventually, and he would at least sound sane about it. He liked her friends. All of them pretty, like she'd been before bloating up like a whale. It was maybe a bit mean of him to hope that she would go missing too. That would take care of that craziness without the business of divorce, and maybe he could marry someone else who wouldn't be so damn shrill. Nope, she'd come home with Eunice in her arms, both of them damp and stinking of rotting fish. He hadn't asked Salma where she'd found Eunice, but now Eunice was babbling about mermaids too, and that was two crazy women in his house. There she was again, arms resting on a shelf at the far end of a line of beach rocks. She stared at him with an intensity that made him wonder. She wasn't that far out from shore. He waved at her, smiling. She ducked a little behind the rock, but bobbed up again, smiling back, he hoped, waving coyly. Simon waded into the water a little experimentally. Monsoon weather made the sea cold at times, but it had been a hot day. But it wasn't too bad, and besides, that woman on the rock looked lonely. As he approached, he realized she also looked fine as hell. Cheekbones like they'd been cut by diamonds, large dark liquid eyes, and her arms were toned like she worked out regularly. And her hair. At first he thought it was black, just like basically everybody else here. But it seemed to have a rainbow sheen to it, as if she had an oil slick in her hair. Or maybe as if her hair was an oil slick.
Oi!
He called. Salam, she replied.
Mind if I hang out with you?
It took her a moment to answer, as if his accent was a problem.
You may.
She was in waist-deep water, and he counted himself lucky to be tall. Being a matsala had its advantages, he thought, as he leaned over the rock to look down into those amazing eyes. Not only that, but clearly he'd lucked out with a freaky girl. She wasn't even wearing a top. Women here wore t-shirts and sarongs at the beach out of modesty, and with the growing Arabization, more of them were buying those swimsuits that covered everything. It was a crying shame. That had never been the case when he visited Asia in his youth. Also a crying shame. The water was cloudy, so he couldn't check out whether she was wearing a bottom. He thought he caught a glimpse of one, a scintillating waistband, but the water sloshed up and he lost sight of it.
So, you live around here?
I move around a lot. You?
Her Malay had an odd accent. He'd heard that the northerners had a different dialect of Malay, but he'd never met anyone who spoke that way before. Still, it gratified him that his Malay was passable enough that a stranger thought he was local.
I'm from America, Sharikat.
How interesting. Your Malay is very good.
Her hand reached up to touch his face.
Is your hair really that color?
He grinned, bending his head down for her to touch his curls. His naturally blonde hair fascinated locals, Her fingers were tentative, and she wrapped a lock around her pinky. Now that her arms were away from her breasts, he could see that they were small, almost flat, but cute all the same.
"So soft," she cooed, letting her hand slip down the back of his head, his neck. "So nice."
"Thanks," he said, about to share his shampoo and conditioning routine. Women love that sort of thing. When he noticed her hand dropping downwards even further, her fingertips drifted across his chest and even lower.
"Oh, wow."
He didn't protest as her hand tugged at his waistband, pulling him around the rock. He stepped around, let her guide his hips so he leaned back. She was fast in unbuttoning and unzipping. Some sort of freaky slut, he thought, aware that he had the same stupid grin from earlier on his face as she got to work on his erection. He gazed down at her rainbow black hair, amazed at how fast she deep-throated him. And what the fuck was her tongue, even? It felt like it was swirling all around his cock, or that maybe she had multiple tongues. He'd have to investigate it after, because it felt so goddamn good. Thunder rolled across the sky, and the waves came in harder. He was impressed. She wasn't stopping, even though the tide was obviously coming in, lapping higher around his hips now, spraying her cheeks.
"Water's coming in," he croaked,
gently but regretfully pushing at her shoulders. She took his hands and put them on her head, on her dark hair, and pressed him against the rock even more firmly. She did not stop, even as the tide came in higher, but he was beyond caring, because this was the best blowjob of his goddamn life, and he wasn't going to let something like nature get in the way. At the back of his mind, he was maybe worried that maybe she might drown if she kept on going, but he gripped her hair and kept thrusting into her throat. Who knows when he might ever meet her again? Maybe he'd get her number.
"I'm gonna come," he gasped out of courtesy.
Vaguely, he realized that he was knee-deep in the sand. When had that happened? Maybe it wasn't the tide coming in after all, but them sinking into the water. He'd ask Salma about it later. He glanced down. What the fuck? She was underwater, dark eyes meeting his and... No, what? Mandibles protruded. No, unfolded from her cheeks and clamped down around his hips. He screamed. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Oh, God. Oh, God. He scrabbled at the rock behind him. The water was higher than before. Pulled at the mandibles. Sweet Jesus, mandibles! But they dug into his flesh deeper, and her arms were wrapped around his legs, and she was sinking into the sand. What the fuck? And pulling him with her. Every effort he made to get out of her grasp made her mandibles dig in further. Help! He shrieked, drowned out by another clap of thunder. Water roared around his ears. She was pulling him underground, underwater, he realized. What the fuck was she? He pushed at the seabed, gasped when she bit down hard. He yelled, "Oh, shit!" underwater, but he was still sinking. The sand was up to his chest now. His lungs burned, his hips were scalding. As the seabed came up around his ears, he swallowed. Water tickled his fingers. Rough sand engulfed them. Eunice. Contrary to its popular name of Bobbit Worm, named after the famous case in which Lorena Bobbit cut off her husband's penis with a scissors, Aphroditus do not have penises, as they are broadcast spawners. Little is known of their mating habits, as very few individual specimens have been found. Mysterious Marine Matings. Eunice dreamed the same dream for a long time. She drifted in the waves, frightened and tired of swimming, and saw a long, large worm swimming towards her. Then a human face and human arms grasping her tightly, lifting her to the surface, allowing her to gasp for air. Eunice rode on the worm woman's back towards shore, but not towards where she had lost her father. She dreamed of falling asleep, dreamed she'd awoken to her mother's cries of relief. In these false awakenings, half lucid with the awareness that she was not really awake, Eunice clung to the worm woman tightly, trying to ask questions, impossible ones like,
"Why does Mom hate me?"
Or,
"Why didn't I get Dad's blue eyes?"
Or,
How come the other kids look at me weird?
Or,
what are men even?
When she was older, she fought with her mother over the details. Her mother insisted that she had found Eunice half-drowned and asleep on the beach. Eunice knew that the worm woman was real, and she half-remembered a conversation between the woman and her mother. It was hard to forget that musical voice, almost like whistles in the dark. She didn't know what the details were anymore, but someone had cried. Eunice plodded along the beach, squinting into the distance. It had taken years, but she was sure that she had finally found the right place. Her mother had tried to throw her off the trail several times.
Oh, no, it was at Sabarong Ris, she'd say. Maybe it was at Pulau Redang, very popular there.
After several fruitless road trips, as well as much rifling through her mother's old documents, Eunice found a relative's phone number that worked, one of many who had shunned her mother after the disappearance of Eunice's father. She had to listen to a long religious screed about the pernicious effects of black magic and a roundabout accusation of her mother, but she finally got the information she wanted. The family had moved far and wide across the peninsula, and no one would balik kampong to where her mother had grown up, but they still remembered the name of the town. There was an isolated lagoon, a tiny one, encroached on all sides with trees growing in the accumulated silt. There weren't even mangrove trees, but evergreens, angsana, and saga, probably brought there by the ocean. Eunice sat down for a while, taking in the sight. There was an opening to the side, and a sandbar that blocked off the lagoon from the ocean. Rocks of all sizes were scattered here and there, beach rocks now obscured by the trees. Something twinkled beside a rock on the edge of the lagoon. Eunice jumped up to investigate. She had to stomp on some saplings, but when she got there, there was nothing but water. Interesting, though. The rock line held back the sand on one side, but on the other, the water looked deep. She kicked off her sandals and pulled on her snorkel. The water was cold for that time of year. It seemed to swallow her. She blew out the water from her snorkel and began to slowly explore along the rock line. Soon she was bumping up against the tree roots of a mangrove swamp. She had half a mind to get out, no telling what poisonous snakes or crocodiles could be living there. But there was something so incredibly familiar about the place, something that twigged at the back of her mind. The silt was so loose here that any little disturbance stirred it up, so Eunice drifted carefully. There, half buried, a woman's body facing up. Eunice clung to a tree root tightly to stare. Was she dead? A flurry of silt went up and the woman was gone. A dark shadow circled around Eunice, and from the sandy cloud a pair of brown arms reached out to her. Eunice froze, letting the hands touch her face, drift over her snorkel mask, brush her bangs back. The sand parted and the woman's face came into view, achingly familiar. She had a broad nose and large dark eyes, and her cheeks seemed to have scars. She swam by, a hand trailing down Eunice's side, dipping into the small of her back. Eunice sucked in her breath at the sight of the long, segmented body beginning from the woman's waist. The bristles on the sides waggled independently of each other, navigating the water. The worm woman swam above Eunice's legs and under, running her hands up from her hips to her waist, the sides of her breasts, and cupped her cheeks. She gently prized one of Eunice's hands from the tree root and tugged, smiling. Eunice let go, let herself be pulled along by this woman. They passed under tunnels of mangrove roots towards open sea and along the coastline to a rocky beach. Eunice pulled herself onto a shelf, water sloshing around her hips as the waves came in. The woman wrapped herself around a rock, leaned forward with a beaming smile. When Eunice pulled off her mask, the smile faltered a little.
You're not Salma?
She wasn't exactly unfriendly, but there was a slight wobble in the music. Eunice shook her head.
I'm Salma's daughter.
She hesitated.
You saved me when I was little.
The woman's gaze swept over her, then she lowered her head to rest her chin on her arms.
Has it been so long?
Sorry.
It's not your fault. I just thought...
But never mind. How is she?
Eunice's mind ran through 1,000 possible answers.
She's fine. She's busy with a new business. She seems lonely. She hates swimming now. She seems happy. She's got a new husband.
She went with the most honest answer.
I don't know. I haven't really talked to her in a while.
She pursed her lips.
She never told me your name.
Those large eyes seemed to glitter in the sunlight. Everything about her seemed iridescent with the sunshine. The brown of her skin had a reflective rainbow sheen, and the curls of her hair resembled an oil slick. The waves rushed to shore. In the distance, herons cawed.
My name is Mayang.
Eunice smiled.
Eunice.
It sounds nice. American name?
A nod.
My father named me.
I see.
Mayang said nothing further about Eunice's father, and even when Eunice casually mentioned him later in the conversation, as in that time when Dad got mad about, and watched Mayang's reaction carefully. But save for a flicker on Mayang's face, he was as good as irrelevant. They wouldn't talk about him after that on further visits, resting after a long swim around the reefs and nearby islands, drilling holes into the bottoms of rich men's yachts with screwdrivers and drills Eunice brought. Mayang would confess to Eunice the fates of former lovers, devoured by sea predators, dead by the poison of pollution, or simply lost to the worldly concerns of humans. Eunice would tell Mayang about the new technologies that had arisen, the advancements scientists were making in space and deep-sea explorations, and the new wars. When they made love, Eunice was torn between jealousy and satisfaction, that her mother had this before she did and would never have it again.
You never talk about yourself,
Mayang interrupted Eunice one day as they lazed in a nest of rocks, Eunice in Mayang's arms. Mayang was not an interrupter, but she couldn't help herself in that moment.
Why is that?
Eunice shrugged.
I'm not a very interesting person.
And went on describing memes. Mayang let it pass until Eunice was done talking. Then she stroked the young woman's hair.
I think you're very interesting.
Eunice caught Mayang's hand and kissed its palm.
I think you're more interesting than me. You live forever under the sea. You see things no human ever could.
She thought for a moment about her never-mentioned father.
Also, you eat people. That's really cool.
Mayang laughed so loudly Eunice was afraid someone would hear them, discover them, and their secret. The seams in her cheeks loosened a little, mandibles almost unfolding in her mirth, but Mayang sobered as quickly as she had laughed.
There is a price to the freedom of the seas.
She was so serious, Eunice had to know.
What is it?
Everything amazing you tell me, every change in the human world will be lost to you,
Mayang answered, hand still stroking Eunice's hair, drifting down.
Death is still a constant danger. There are so few of us, torn apart by the tides, I don't even know where the others are anymore.
I found you easily.
I like to stay put. Fishing here is easy. There are so many more tourists than before.
She smoothed the fabric of Eunice's panties.
But no more this feeling good here, because you won't have it anymore.
Eunice let Mayang's hand linger, weighing the truth of the statement. Eunice's worm body explorations had turned up nothing sensitive. She parted her knees a little and pressed the hand further down. Mayang's fingers played with a stray hair, but withdrew after a moment.
You're so young, Eunice. Go, live a full life. The sea is for bitter old crones like me.
Eunice turned to kiss Mayang's cheek and trailed her lips along a mandible seam.
You're not a crone, she murmured,
brushing sand off Mayang's brown skin, flicking a cake of silt off a breast. It was small,
mostly vestigial muscle left over from years of swimming in the ocean.
And I'm not that young.
She kissed Mayang, working her fingers into the worm woman's mouth to reach places her tongue could not reach. Mayang's mouth, the loose membrane, the soft muscles, pressed down, not to push Eunice out, but to draw her in. In a busy embrace, Eunice straddled Mayang, stretching the length of herself along to brush against the bristles that fluttered in a way Eunice noticed only happened when they kissed. The epidermis along Mayang's body cracked as it dried. It did not happen often, Mayang had told Eunice, and really only meant she had a new segment to her body. Eunice helped peel the old skin off and marveled at the polished iridescence beneath. She ran her fingers across the new skin, soft for now, until it toughened over time, and grinned to hear Mayang moaning. She carefully stripped the length of Mayang's body, fingers dancing between parapodia to a startling cacophony from Mayang. When she reached the final segment, throbbing with its newness, she embraced it, showering it with kisses, while Mayang arched her back, mandibles unfurling wide in a long, ragged cry. The afternoon sun had gone down by the time they rested. "When there were more of us," Mayang whispered, eyes closed in dreamy afterglow. "We met during molting season. What a shame there are so few of us now." Eunice went home and quit her job. She closed her bank accounts, all social media possible, wrote several letters that were along the lines of,
"Don't look for me."
Her mother tried to withhold her car keys and her identity card, as if those were things Eunice needed anymore. Concerned acquaintances tried to call, but Eunice turned off her phone and removed the SIM card. Off the shore of Trunganu, where it was still dark enough for moonlight to set the white sands aglow, Eunice rode Mayang's back to an island of rocks too small for development, too rocky for trees.
"Will it be painful?"
"Very." Mayang actually couldn't remember anymore.
"Will you be there when I wake up?"
"Yes." Mayang lied because anything could happen. They tumbled onto a bed of sand together, kissing and licking and tasting, Eunice wrapped around Mayang. Mayang ran her pharynx over the length of Eunice's neck, chest, belly, while her fingers found the human cleft and thrust deep, feeling along the lines of the wet walls for throbbing muscle. Eunice gripped Mayang's hair, a little alarmed at the sudden engorgement from Mayang's mouth, taking teeth across her clavicle, the round of her breasts, and every sensitive spot Mayang knew. She swallowed the bile of terror as Mayang's head settled between her legs, mandibles unfurling and foaming at the edges. Water rose around her hips. Mayang bit deeper, seeking the second heartbeat, splitting skin and flesh. Eunice screeched as Mayang's teeth-lined pharynx burrowed around her clitoris, nerve ending shattered and ripped apart. The froth turned bloody, burning, blazing as seawater rose. Eunice clamped her legs together, almost catching Mayang's neck, and Mayang ducked away to let the transformation begin. Eunice squeezed her legs shut, gasped in shock between sobs, while Mayang rubbed her arms up and down and stroked her hair and crooned an old song. The blood from Eunice, the foam from Mayang, the salt of the sea all would bubble together to form a cocoon. So sleep, so fade away, let the warm blood go. The water rose, and Eunice felt the moonlight ebb from her vision. Everything grew cold and dark and silent, except for Mayang's voice. Eunice dreamed of entwining with Mayang over and over, of exploring the ocean depths and each other, of the freedom of the shifting sea. Coda. "Do you know, Eunice? I cannot remember the last time I witnessed a metamorphosis. When the water covered you, the foam turned into a thin film that reminded me of bloody calls over babies. Unpleasant memories. When you wake up, I hope you will not mind having been buried in the silk of the mangrove, because I had forgotten how much men are prone to roaming in their boats these days,
their mastery over the ocean allowing them a greater range. You will also have more food around when you wake up, and I will be there to catch them with you and teach you how. And I can already sense that you will not be happy in this sleepy little beachside. So we will drift across the oceans to find old shipwrecks and waylay unhappy boats. We will delve into the trenches to find the Methuselahs who feed on whales and deep sea squid in between their slumbering eons. Maybe we will find others like us. Maybe we will make more like us. Maybe in the far future you will leave me anyway, but it will not matter by then. Sleep easy, my little Eunice.
Three variations on a theme of imperial attire. E. Lily Yu. They never tell the story right. The Danish must have their heavens and happy endings, and Andersen's tales are meant for children. We, however, you and I, know that people are people, and every one of us is capable of... But the story. Once there was a vain and foolish emperor who made up for his foolishness by a kind of low cunning. As such rulers do, he drew to himself a retinue of like men and women who told him he was wise and humble, gracious and good. The emperor would smile at their flattery, which in his wisdom he knew to be the truth, and lavish gold and gems and deeds upon them. Thus was everyone contented within the palace walls, and those outside got on as well as they could. Eventually, with narrative inevitability, two men with knapsacks and pockets full of thread came knocking at the palace gates.
"We are tailors," the first one said, "wise but humble tailors, who seek to offer our boutique services to men of might, such as yourself."
"Here is our list of bona fides," said the second man. "Sterling references, one and all."
"The very best, I'm sure,"
the emperor said, looking at the ruby buttons on their vests of gilt brocade.
"What we'd like to offer you is an exclusive deal, the latest in fashion, which no one else owns, designed in collaboration with a distant country's military-industrial complex, top secret and cutting edge, the Loyalty Distinguisher line of couture."
"What a mouthful," the emperor said, looking askance. "Call it something I can pronounce."
"What a brilliant suggestion. The Thresher, how's that? Since it sorts the wheat from the worthless chaff."
"Powerful," the emperor said. "I like it."
"Now, the key selling point of the Thresher line, what a wonderful name, is that it'll let you sort at a glance your loyal, meritorious, and worthy subjects from, well, the useless ones."
"At a glance, eh?"
"Indeed. When we dress you in Thresher fabric, cut to the height of style, those subjects of noble character will see you as you truly are, with all your hidden virtues displayed. They'll swoon at your intellect, marvel at your power, gape at your discernment and understanding. You'll know them by their raptures and fits of joy. Then you can place them in positions of authority, judging village disputes and distributing grain, for example, or tax collecting."
"Good,"
the emperor said, rubbing his chin.
"And the rest?"
"The Thresher fabric will reflect their true ugliness. They will pale and shrink back and avert their eyes. They will scream and faint. They will whimper at the sight of their deepest selves. And thus you will know your traitorous subjects. Hard labor would be too good for them."
"Make me this suit at once,"
the emperor said. And his court, whispering amongst themselves, wondered how the marvel would be managed. Well, you know how. The tailors placed loud orders on the phone for Italian leather and French wool, Japanese silks and bulletproof thread, had conspicuously large boxes airlifted to their quarters, and all day and all night they cut and sewed the air with an industry that was inspiring to see. The appointed day came red and hot. Crows rattled in the palace trees.
In the emperor's chamber, before his cheval glass, the tailors presented their work with pride.
Our finest piece! A triumph! A breakthrough in fashion! But let us see what it looks like on you. Habeas corpus is the haberdasher's true test.
The emperor looked at their empty hands, swallowed, scowled, thought, and said,
Bravo!
Is the jacket not to your liking?
Yes, the pants are a little long.
I'll fix that in a minute, never you worry. There. How's that?
Perfect,
the emperor said, gazing at his reflection. Now you must show it to your subjects. Your courtiers have assembled and are waiting.
When the emperor strode into his court, a ruby-buttoned tailor at each elbow, his courtiers stared. Then one, then another, hastily applauded, and the stamping and cheering shook the walls. A little color came back into the emperor's cheeks, and he wuffed through his blonde whiskers in relief, though what terrible worry he had been relieved of, no one watching could say.
You chose your court wisely, the tailor said. Now ride throughout your kingdom and sift the wicked from the good. And the emperor, glancing dubiously at the saddle, mounted his horse and rode through the city streets. His stomach billowed with every bounce. Before him rode his courtiers, shouting the people forth to praise the craftsmanship and glory of these new clothes, which would divide the loyal from the perfidious. The people, who had not survived 6 decades of imperial whims and sudden prohibitions on various fruits, fats, and hats without acquiring a certain degree of sense, observed the wind's direction and vociferously admired the blinding gleam of the cloth of gold, the shimmer of silks, the cut and fit of everything. Children, however, who through lack of life experience have not yet learned the salubrious lessons of unjust pain, while quite disposed to lie to avoid immediate punishment, are also inclined to speak inconvenient truths at the most inconvenient times.
Ma, the emperor is naked. No, he's not. He's wearing the finest suit that I ever did see. Ma, I can see his dick.
At this, the goodwife clapped her aproned hand over her son's mouth, but it was too late. The emperor had heard. He turned a pitying eye upon them, as their neighbors immediately began to point and hiss. Why, they'd always known. An absent father. Single motherhood stirred up evil, that's what they'd always said. But the emperor's getup was magnificent, truly unparalleled. Only a stupid blind woman couldn't see that. The emperor nudged his horse with his knees and serenely continued upon his way. In the morning, the boy and his mother were gone. Their little stone and thatch cottage had burned to the ground. Their neighbors and their houses had vanished as well. Only a few cracked teeth and a fistful of phalanges were found. The emperor retained the tailors on an exclusive contract at astronomical rates and took to riding out among his people on a weekly basis, since it was now clear that there was treachery in the land. People fell over themselves to report their parents, in-laws, rivals, classmates, colleagues, never failing to praise the newest suit of clothes themselves, until the streets turned black with blood and soot. When the emperor was finally stricken with a fatal case of pneumonia, which happened far later than one might imagine, because he was a corpulent and well-insulated man, his former subjects, one after the other, dazed by the news, picked up the phone by habit to denounce their friends, and heard on the other end the dusty silence of a dead line. Unnecessarily grim, you say? Unrealistic? Scenes this bloody no longer occur in the civilized world? I agree with all your criticisms, most erudite of readers. There's nothing for it but to try again. Here, then, is a more charming tale, one that will better suit your taste. Once there was a body politic that, through happy geographic accident, had avoided any number of devastating wars, and was thus left the most powerful government in the world. On the basis of that evidence, it thought itself the most enlightened body politic that the world had ever seen. It kept its citizens under surveillance, arresting or ejecting those who did not agree, and as a result enjoyed unanimous approbation. One day, 2 men, sons of a vast clothing empire, who had recently been elected to the body,
presented a sheaf of invisible bills.
See how stylishly we've cut, trimmed, and hemmed taxes? How popular you'll be with the tastemakers of this realm. How perceptive and attractive you'll seem if you pass them. See how they funnel the vast majority of money to the military, which is always fashionable. How powerful you'll look to your enemies. Look how your children will benefit, leapfrogging into elite universities, flourishing in the compost of your trusts and estates. All honorable members of this body politic will see the good, glorious vision these bills represent. All citizens of discernment shall agree. The others? Well, they are not citizens, or they are fake citizens, voting without proper identification, and we should divert a portion of our security budget to uncovering these traitors and deporting or imprisoning them, as our fathers did in their day. The platforms and proposals were trotted before the country with pleasing pomp and ceremony. The true citizens applauded them so loudly you couldn't think, and trained in militias to hunt down the fake citizens, and rammed cars into the bodies of fake citizens, and phoned in denunciations of their neighbors, ex-lovers, grandchildren, pets. And before too long, the streets ran black and red with... That didn't go very well, did it? Heavy-handed, on the nose. It's hardly even a story. The artistic error was choosing a plurality as a subject. It's difficult to create complexity of character, complete with inner conflicts and landscapes and unique worldviews, when one's protagonist is an amorphous group, especially when the members are as slippery as politicians. I understand now why Anderson chose to write about an emperor rather than, say, the Reichstag. Artistically, that is. Never mind that the first Reichstag convened 12 years after his fairy tale was published. That detail will be conveniently left out of my forthcoming treatise on art. It is a treatise written for a very select few and will be scorned by the unenlightened masses. Only a humble and wise reader such as yourself, magnanimous and perfect in character, will understand the secrets I disclose therein. So a character study is what's needed, it seems. Once there were two tailors. You know what? You're right. We don't need both of them. They're hardly distinguishable as it is. Anderson might have wished to signify the multitudinousness of such men, or illustrate how well they work together once they recognize each other, but we can take that for granted as something the reader already knows. Once there was a man who called himself whatever was suitable to his purposes at the time. If it profited him to say he was a soldier, then he was a soldier who had served with distinction. If it furthered his aims to call himself beloved, then someone's sweetheart he was. By speaking the words that another person wished to hear, whether those words were flattery or promises or blame, he could insinuate himself into most others' trust. He had few talents besides this one, and a loathing for honest work besides, but this one talent proved enough to feed and clothe him until such time that the trick was plain. By then, of course, the man was long gone. He fed at first on the labor of farmers, progressing at length to literate merchants and clerks. Over and over, his living proved to him the moral by which he compassed his world, that the slow and stupid existed to be ruled and robbed by cleverer and better men than they. But the smell of damp wool and the low burr of laborers came to displease him. The damp, wormy odors of ancient books soon bored him. In short, there are only so many times a bright man of tremendous worth can fleece the same kind of idiot. The reward is small, the dupery tedious. One must establish trust, perform small favors, establish rapport and commonalities, and so on and so forth, and that routine grows repetitive. The man longed to leave a mark on the face of history, as a result of which he could no longer be ignored. And to do that, one must be proximate to greatness. So the man who would call himself anything stashed away the profits of his cleverness until he could move to the valley of kings and queens, where starry fortunes were built upon a vastness of sand. Like pharaohs, these men and women lived erecting monuments and pressing whole hosts into hard labor, and word of their power and wealth had come to his ears.
The man bid farewell to the women who all thought themselves his one and only love, with haste and without many tears, since he did not expect to see them again. He did not kiss the infant boy that one held, with his own dark hair and dimpled cheeks. Time and space did not chain our storyteller, for the stories he told disregarded both as soon as they became inconvenient. And so, by steamer and coach, greyhound and plane, the man made his way to the Valley of Sand. And where money flows and ebbs in deep tide like the sea, shifting mountains, crashing, storming, drowning, the humblest barnacle is sufficiently wetted if it only clings to a firm surface. So the man lived, studying the landscape, until he heard the clack of dice in every two shells rolled along by the sea. With adjustments to his former patterns, he grabbed small fortunes with the wire cage of his smile and landed wish-granting carp with his tongue for bait. A little empire he eked out, nestling against the greater fortunes and powers that ironed the land flat, effacing a neighborhood there, shredding communities there. From the kings of that land he learned to spin his silken webs to catch not one fly but 1,000. Once stuck in his flatteries, they squirmed to be sucked, pleading to be wrapped in his glorious silks, and he, like a spider, was glad to oblige. Dining on every rare delicacy, traveling to white-dusted parties by limo and helicopter, he was contented for a time. Then, as he listened, as he grew familiar with that land, he learned that these kings were clever but lesser, that an emperor ruled over them, and that this emperor was a fool. The kings simpered and groveled when they came before the emperor, just as this man did before them. Bit by bit, the glitter of the Valley of Kings faded. The man grew restless and hungry once more. Late at night, he spun plans to weave himself into the imperial court and staff. Favors were asked here, a rumor murmured there. A few careers had to be ended to clear the way, but what of it? Soon, an invitation on cream-thick paper made its way into his hand. All was ready, the story staged, waiting only for the curtain and the lights. On the morning the man walked out of his old apartment for the last time, a plane ticket clutched in one hand. He found a boy no older than 15, dressed in the clothes of another era, standing in the building's entryway.
"Excuse me," the man said, stepping around the boy.
"You're my father," the boy said.
"I don't have a son."
"Here's a picture of us. I was 3 at the time."
"That could be anyone."
"It's you. I didn't come to bother you. I only wanted to ask."
"You're making me late."
"Why you left. Why we weren't enough for you."
"Nothing personal. Nothing to do with you. But look at your mother. Was I supposed to grow old with that? In that small ratty house? In that backwater of a time and place? No. I am meant for greater things."
"She said you were a tailor."
"I do stitch, weave, and spin."
"Will you teach me to be a tailor, too?"
"In 10 minutes, I'm going to miss my flight, which will cause me to miss a very important appointment. See, I'm on a tight schedule. Call me another time."
"But," the boy said, looking after him, "I don't have your number."
"So sorry, your imperial grandiloquence," the man said several hours later. "Encountered an unavoidable delay. But now that I'm here, my various skills as a tailor are at your praiseworthy self's disposal. I can sew you an outfit, invisible, that all your subjects must nonetheless kiss the hems of and admire. Sew half-truths and falsehoods together until a listener can't tell head from tail. Weave tales to turn brother against brother, snipping all bonds of loyalty except to you. These matters make my trade."
"Be welcome here," the emperor said. "I can tell that you are a gifted man."
And the emperor threw a fistful of peas at him.
"Quick, a suit that will make me irresistible. I need it in 5 minutes. The Queen of Sheba is coming."
"Immediately,"
the tailor said. But when the tailor returned after 4 minutes, carrying a suit of exaggerations, the emperor was already pawing at the queen, who resisted with an expression of deep distaste, extracted herself, and stormed off.
Where were you?
The Emperor said, mashing a handful of gravy into the tailor's hair. I told you to be done in 2 minutes. You took 10. The tailor said,
That's right, O golden son of wisdom. I didn't get to fuck her because of you. To make amends for your disappointment, may I offer you this suit of impregnable armor?
And he held out again the invisible clothes that mere minutes before had been an irresistible suit.
Don't be stupid. I can't get pregnant. Ah, but this suit protects you from all harm. Gimme, the Emperor said, and was quickly dressed.
Even though his wares were intangible, producing enough of them to please the Emperor and thus avoid the latest flung dish of baked beans proved exhausting for the soi-disant tailor. He spun the three-piece of plausible denial, the vest and cravat of high-event attendance, the cufflinks of venality. Each time, the Emperor toyed with his work, tried it on, pronounced himself satisfied, and promptly forgot it existed.
May I suggest, the depleted tailor said, stripping the populace of their rights, so that no one has rights but the most righteous of all, which is to say you, our rightness, you who are never wrong.
Why not?
The Emperor said. That was carried out, despite demonstrations and strikes and scathing newspaper columns, and then the tailor had to invent a new diversion. What about setting neighbor against neighbor and stranger against stranger? Tell the old story of the dark-skinned foreigner with his knife dripping blood. A little chaos does for power what warm horseshit does for weeds.
Whatever you like, said the triply-clothed emperor. Next!
And those foreign-born, or born to foreigners, or born to those born to foreigners, were rounded up, accused of crimes, and variously punished.
May I suggest plucking the flower of youth before it grows strong enough to revolt?
Let it be so, the Emperor said. Across the realm, children were mown down like green grass ahead of the mower's scythe. Even the onion-eyed kings in their silicon towers felt their quartz hearts crack and said, No more. But they spoke it softly so the Emperor would not hear. And while the tailor measured and spun and snipped, the murmur of the people rose to a roar. For there remained some of intelligence and clear thinking and good judgment among them, and these had gently taught the rest to put on new eyes and see. On a day when the Emperor was deliberating between the empty suit of universal belovedness on the tailor's left arm and the trousers and blazer of religious authority draped over his right, a herald ran in with the report that a mob had smashed through the palace gates and was headed toward the Emperor's palace. Indeed, through the window, they could see a dark storm of humanity swelling on the horizon. All that stood between that flood and the doors was a line of police with loaded rifles. Most of the mob was children, with some old women mixed in, and some young, as well as a few brave men, and they stepped over the bodies of those who were shot and pressed forward to the palace, inevitable as death. The tailor, with the instinct of a hare, twitched and backed toward the exit. The Emperor said, Sit! And the tailor sat. At a snap of the Emperor's fingers, servants tugged the curtain shut so that they could no longer see the cresting wave. The lights were switched off. They waited in darkness.
Bring me a bottle, the Emperor said, and poured two fingers of 60-year-old liquor into two glasses.
One he drank, one he emptied over the tailor.
That suit, the Emperor said, that prevents all harm. I'm wearing it now. But what will you do, clever tailor, when they come through these doors?
Distantly, over the gunfire, they could hear the children singing, and the song rose sweet and clear on the wind. Soon there began at the palace doors a heavy and fateful thudding, like that of a heart under terrible strain. All the world, it seemed, kind and cruel alike, had come to beat down the palace doors. If you'll excuse me, I am now going to join them. Heaven help the children. Heaven help us all.